And so I graphed my palette. I created these drawings to go along with my tasting notes, and we call them vinpressions. So they are basically the impression of the wine as it moves from the front to the back of my palate.
Welcome, and thank you for listening to the Next Gen Podcast, a conversational series with members from Energen Wealth Partners at UBS. With an understanding of the family dynamics that can accompany multi-generational wealth, we are experienced in working with you and your family to develop a strategic plan to guide your decisions. Our approach helps provide education across generations to help define and support your long-term vision for your wealth.
Hello, and welcome to the Next Gen Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Vansemays, an executive director and financial advisor with Intergen Wealth Partners here at UBS Financial Services. Our office and studio is located in Dayton, Ohio, and you can reach us at intergen@ubs.com. Today, I'm thrilled to explore the fascinating world of winemaking with an inspiring guest who's made a remarkable impact on the industry. Joining me is Jordan Fiorentini, Vice President of Winemaking and Vineyards at Epic Estate Wine. Since 2010, Jordan has led her team in crafting wines that consistently earn top scores from critics and appear on prestigious top 100 lists. Originally from Atlanta, Georgia, she began her journey with an engineering degree from Dartmouth, followed by a master's in viticulture and enology from UC Davis. Her winemaking path taken her through Tuscany, Napa, Sonoma, before she found her home in Paso Robles at Epic. Okay, so Jordan, every good story starts at the beginning. So tell us a little bit about where you grew up, you know, what your interests were, and also there must have been something that happened along the way relating to wine that struck you. So tell us a little bit about your background way back then.
Well, yes, definitely. It's a long time ago, so I'm going to have to think back. I used to tell this story much more often. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, so not a winemaking region. Well, until more recently, because there's wineries and vineyards in every state. My parents both loved wine. My father, he's retired. I'll get into what he ended up doing later, but he was an attorney in Atlanta. And just, you know, I think like we have a lot of attorneys who are members, and they, when they get done with their day job, they're just so studious. They love to turn that sort of side of themselves onto a passion. And so he turned it onto wine. And was really lucky in timing because he started collecting wine in 1982 and basically where everyone goes to start collecting wine, which would be Bordeaux. And I think 82 is like the best year ever.
There's nice. Never been.
And so he just happened to buy those wines when they were $25 a bottle. It started his wine passion. And then my mom just loved to drink it. And so I knew about fine wine from a young age, and I just always knew that it existed as a career path. When we'd go on family vacations, my dad would also find whatever winery was in the region, and we'd visit. And so unlike most of my peers in Georgia at the time, who thought maybe winemaking was like basket weaving, home ec or something, I don't know, like, what are you going off to for your college? And then, like, why would you study wine? But I didn't know at that point I wanted to do wine. I just knew it existed. And so then fast forward, I go to undergrad. I went to Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. It's a liberal arts school, so everyone gets a Bachelor of Arts, but I also took a bunch of science classes. I was studying engineering, did a lot of chemistry, but you have to study abroad there, or not study abroad, but you have to get a certain amount of language credits. And so because I was doing so much stuff that made sense, I wanted to do some fun artsy things that didn't make sense in my studies necessarily on paper. So I decided to study Italian and go to Italy. And I also took a bunch of studio art classes. So that didn't make sense at that moment. But then towards the end of my time at Dartmouth, everyone was off going to, you know, getting management consulting jobs and working on Wall Street, but I just didn't know what I wanted to do. But I knew I wanted something that mixed art and science, and it would be great if I could get back to Italy. And so I decided to just, you know, maybe go work a harvest in Napa Valley. That was my idea. And then I actually was going to go back to Dartmouth and get a degree or a master's of business and engineering at their Tuck School. So I had the plan to do that. So I went, the harvest of 1999, I went to Napa Valley and worked at Markham Vineyards in the heyday of Merlot before the Sideways movie. and I fell in love with the industry. It was, Napa was amazing at that point. It was discovered, but not completely discovered. I just knew it was a very narrow path, but I decided I wasn't going to go back to get a degree I didn't know what I was going to do with. And I decided to apply to UC Davis for their master's in winemaking and viticulture, which also had an internship in Italy. So,
wow, you got lucky on that.
But you're young, you know, I was super young. And I was just like, I'm going to do this. And it makes sense on paper. And it mixes science and art, which was very important. But yeah, I just kind of followed my passion after I had built up sort of a background in science.
So you complete the degree program, and what happens there? Like, how did you kind of break into the business after the academics were over?
Yeah, so I did study in Italy after 1 year there. It was like a 2-year program, but you had to finish a thesis. And when I was in Italy, I actually met my husband. And we were trying to figure out where we were going to go. Were we going to like live in Italy and work in, you know, was I going to work in the wine industry there? We were going to stay in the United States. And we decided that he would come over. And at the same time, my mom and my dad decided to start a small vineyard and winery in the North Georgia mountains. So we actually started, I had worked several internships in Napa and Sonoma, but then we decided to move to North Georgia after I got my degree. And we helped them build that winery. And we stayed there for a few years. And this is where the luck, I think, just comes. I just was looking at a bunch of jobs that were available. We knew we wanted to move to California. The climate was sort of more similar to Italy. I don't know why we didn't like try to stay in Italy more at that time. I think it was just hard to figure out how to make a living over there, especially in the wine industry, if you're not born into a winemaking family. So I applied to just a bunch of jobs. I had actually flown out to California to have an internship at one winery in Napa. And at that time, I saw another job posting and I answered it and could interview that day, basically. And I ended up getting hired at Chalk Hill, which is in Sonoma County, but really close to the Napa line. And it was because of the person that hired me that it like changed the trajectory of my career.
Wow, that's great. I have to ask, is the Georgia winery still ongoing concern, is it really?
It still exists. They, you know, it's really hard to grow grapes in that sort of climate, humidity and rain. Soils are a lot more lush too and nutrient rich. They do still grow grapes, and they also have sort of, you know, like a food venue and wedding venue. It's been really difficult though. I mean, I think when I was there, it was sort of that heyday. They had just really good weather for a few, you know, it's like it was in cycles. It was before these crazy hurricanes kept coming from the Gulf or from Florida. There was this sort of moment in time where there were less of them, and then we got into a cycle of more. And they've had some really cold winters, which is also really difficult, as you guys probably know out there. But yeah, it still exists though. A lot of wineries that are in other states do purchase fruit from the West Coast to keep their brands afloat. My parents didn't do that for a really long time, but they've had a couple fun projects out here too to get some wine over there.
Well, that's cool. So you started kind of really your first journey into California was Chalk Hill. And I think about our industry and here in wealth management, and it's really been a male-dominated industry. My presumption is that wine was probably the same. So can you talk a little bit about what did that look like then? How has it changed? And how have you kind of navigated as a woman winemaker?
It's definitely changed. I have to say that I just either had blinders on, I think it was just like a ton of luck and like we just had worked for amazing, amazing people that just it didn't really pop up. But I think it's more of like a cultural thing where like, and I think I'm of the era where the women were more in the winery. Like there weren't as many, but they were entering into winemaking, not entering into viticulture. So that was kind of my era. And I would say that it would have been a little bit more daunting for me to say I want to be in the vineyard, like a viticulturist, not winemakers always in the vineyard, but to be in charge of a vineyard and like the crews and all that kind of stuff. I still think that it's a lot better now, but I still think that the viticulture side is the harder side when speaking, you know, gender specifics, just because of the hours, if you have a family, but then also the dynamic with having to you know, manage some, like, a lot of male-dominated crews, you know, just like lots of tractor work, lots of equipment stuff. But it has changed in that. And then there are also just so many more women winemakers and women viticulturists now that it's really fascinating. But I think that both, okay, so I had several internships and I was always working for women winemakers. So that was like my role models. But then I got hired at Chalk Hill by Steve Levesque, who is a sort of veteran winemaker of Napa Valley. And because this man had hired me and had this faith in me, and then he ended up moving on and he wanted me to be promoted, you know, to the head winemaker. I just had also this great mentor and role model in him that didn't see gender, didn't, you know, just looking at me and my abilities. Yeah, like I said, there was kind of a stroke of luck, but then, you know, also just the timing and the culture at that moment.
Oh, that's great. Well, so what happens between Chalk Hill and Epic?
So Chalk Hill, I don't know if you know a history of it, but it was owned by a man named Fred Firth, who is a famous class action attorney in San Francisco, had lots of success, and he started this sort of wild winery, you know, up in the hills, like an hour and a half from San Francisco. He ran that place, and it was always just kind of like crazy but fun and, you know, doing lots of stuff. And then he ended up, life was changing for him. He was getting older, and you guys are in the financial world. It was like 2007, 2008. There was a lot of not great stuff going on. And he ended up looking like he needed to sell the winery. And I was, you know, didn't want to be a corporate winemaker just because I hadn't been reared in that environment. I had been reared in a kind of like, you make the best wine no matter what, no matter what the cost, no matter what, you know, you just have to present your case. And I was like, okay, I guess maybe it's time for me to get my resume together. It looks like this corporate empire is going to buy Chalk Hill. So that's what I did. And I started looking locally. And then I was sort of talking to, there was this winemaker friend, woman I knew up there. She had called me about this job down here in Paso Robles. And at the same moment, I had gotten a text from my mentor at Chalk Hill, who had since moved on, who knew what was going to happen at Chalk Hill. He had just heard. He was like, word on the street. It was like all happening at the same time. And I said, I don't want to really move to Paso Robles, but my interest has piqued. My assistant winemaker at the time and my neighbors had both gone to Cal Poly and just sort of raved about the Paso Robles or San Luis Obispo County. They were just obsessed with it. Like anyone I had met who had ever been in SLO County was completely obsessed with this area. So I was like, well, I've never been down there, but I don't know. I'm kind of interested. And they were making some really interesting Rhone wines, which I dabbled in that at Chalk Hill. I just had like a few hundred cases of a Syrah and a little bit of Viognier, and I was intrigued. And I just said, okay, I'll interview for this job, but we're not going to move. I interviewed. I ended up again reiterating that we would not move. And then the headhunter just said, the owners of Epic, Bill and Liz Armstrong, they just want to meet you. You know, they're going to bring you and your family down to Paso. Don't worry, you're not wasting their time. Because that was a big thing with me. I didn't want to waste anyone's time. And I met them. And then the rest is history. I mean, what is this, like 15, almost 16 years later? And I'm like, I still feel like I could go back in my mind and think about those moments. But it was just like, I won the lottery. Because like, you know, when you interview, everyone's on their best behavior. So you're going to just see the best side of people. But then when you find out, like, after that interview process and real life sets in and there's just even more amazing than you thought, like, you're like, wow, that was so lucky. So lucky.
Wow. Well, that's great. So speaking of Epic, and this is an audio, right? So people can't see, but for a while I had been buying your wine before I really talked to anyone and I was mispronouncing the name. So for those of you who are listening, it's E-P-O-C-H. And Jordan, can you tell us a little bit about the genesis of the name?
Yeah. So Bill and Liz met in a freshman geology class at SMU, and they got married right after college, but they're both geologists. And when you're looking to start a winery, you have to find a name that no one else has. And that's really difficult because all the names are taken, but they found the word epic, which the E-P-O-C-H, epoch or epoch, just not epooch, because we get that sometimes. Oh, means a grand period of geologic time. And for viticulturists and winemakers trying to make a wine that represents where it's grown, the soil that it's in is really important. And especially in Paso, where the rocks are just so significant and different than other areas in the New World, especially California, that name just made sense. Bill will joke to this day, it's still not like he just still doesn't love it. But I was like, I love it because it represents us. That's why I love it so much, you know? So that, yeah, we just became it. And then we just sort of, I guess, defined what the name meant over the years.
Well, that's great. So tell me a little bit about how Epic has transformed during the 15 years or so that you've been there, you know?
Yeah. So if anyone's been to Paso and they've been on the West Side, probably about 15, 20 years ago, a lot of activity was focused around this one vineyard or one winery called Denner. They had a vineyard and winery, but they had built a big space. So they had a bunch of winemakers that could make wine in there too. So it was kind of like this shark tank, like you're like think tank kind of thing. Like we're all just like in there making wine together. So Epic was lucky enough to be one of the, I don't know, 7 to 10 wineries that was housed in this environment. And it was so great. And we were all just collaborating all the time. And that feeling goes over all of Paso still, just this massive collaboration and friendship between all the winemakers. But for me, being in the Napa and Sonoma world, that wasn't the case there. Like my winemaking friends weren't like, basically here, I feel like all my friends were winemakers for many, many years until I like branched out and my kids had friends and then their parents became my friends and that kind of thing. But for a while, all the winemakers, they just all just embraced me when I moved here. But in Napa, that wasn't the case. It was harder. You had to like work with them or people had gone to Davis with. And so that was really special. But it was just, I feel like it was kind of born in this nexus that was Denner. So we were making our wine there. We had two vineyards. We knew that we were going to build a winery, but we weren't quite sure where. We were going to either build it on one of the two vineyard properties or maybe a third. And at about that same time, Bill and Liz, who Liz loves history, had sort of come across the York Mountain historic vineyard and winery property that is one of, or if not the oldest bonded winery in our county. And so they were looking at York Mountain when I first joined the team as a potential site for a winery and a vineyard and a tasting room. We didn't have a tasting room at that point. And so really that last 15 years have been like building a winery, adding York Mountain as one of our vineyards, which is actually outside of the Paso Robles appellation, and building a tasting room, building a following, showing the world like not only what our style of wines were, but that we were going to be constantly pushing the envelope, but consistent, age-worthy wines that were super, they're super indicative of where they're grown, you know, just kind of like almost growing with Paso Robles, because Paso has definitely been put on the map in that time period as well.
As you know, I'm a big fan and consume a lot of your wine. And one of the things that's remarkable to me about Epic is I love every wine in the portfolio, so to speak. There's lots of wineries where I like one or two of theirs, but there's something about your style and the property and everything that, you know, that you could throw a dart at a board with Epic Wines and find a great one. So we've talked about you and Bill and Liz, but any other folks on the staff that are notable? And also, you talked a little bit about the difference for women winemakers versus viticulturists. So do you have a viticulturalist or are you both?
Great questions. And I love what you said about the wines. That's always been a goal of mine is like, we tell people, if you don't like white, you don't like rosé, we should just try ours because you might like it. And they'll just be like, wow, I do actually like that, you know, or a Zinfandel, right? It's made in this sort of more sophisticated way. I have the most amazing assistant winemaker. I have a shout out to so many people at Epic. I love everyone here. It is such a family. Bill and I always talked about creating this like kind of what is the culture, like the work culture of Epic. And we could never define it, but then it, you know, it starts at the top with them and then just amazing people that work here. But for me personally and the consistency, it comes down to, well, no, Bill and Liz obviously letting us kind of have carte blanche and the reins and being super supportive of all the trials and the, you know, the risks and all those things that we're willing to take, especially earlier. And they still are now. But my assistant winemaker, he's been with me since 2012. He's a local, but he just absorbs like all of the goals we want and he holds them tight no matter who's working with us, what interns we hire during harvest. Like, he oversees all of them and makes sure that our winemaking practices and the end goal of making the best possible wine is always in sight. And this ties to the second question. I might have their 2 years mixed up. It's been so long. Zach, I think, started at the end of 2011. And my vineyard manager, Kyle, started in 2012. And Kyle, he's a little further south, but also somewhat local. And it was really important to me when I was hired at Chalk Hill, I was the winemaker and we had a vineyard manager / viticulturist. And that was a difficult dynamic because he called, when I got promoted, I was like 30, and he called me, "You're number 8. And I was like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "You're the 8th winemaker I've worked with, you know? So it's like, you're kind of not going to tell me what to do." But then when I came here, I was in charge of both the vineyard and the winery. And I just wanted a seamless interaction between vineyard management and winemaking. That was the most important thing for me. I never wanted to say or never felt like I have every answer for the vineyard or the winery. I just want to work with people that were like willing to find the answers, willing to try, look at new techniques. And so I found Kyle to come in. I really wanted to move to organics and biodynamics to really help our goal of producing wines that were a direct reflection of where they were grown. I didn't want a lot of external inputs. And we shared that philosophy. And he was actually like a winemaking. He was on the vineyard, but also winemaking side before. So he had done both. So we always taste together, always talk about winemaking together. For the first many years of harvest, he would finish in the vineyard and come, you know, crush grapes with us. Having both of those people kind of grow with me at this brand, we're just like in this sort of seamless dance that we kind of end each other's sentences, pick up where the person left off. And then the sales and marketing team has just been so great of like super supportive of like whatever we throw at them. Like, want to make this wine, or we only have this much of that, or what did Mother Nature gave us? Like, everybody's super flexible.
Well, my credit card bill is a testament to your sales and marketing team.
They are. They're incredible.
Well, I'll tell you talked about the dance between you. I think you need a vinpression of what that feels like. We'll talk more about that. So circling back, so we talked about you and your career. We talked about Epic and how it's changed. Let's talk a little bit about the Paso region itself. So what would you say kind of defines Paso? And then also your vineyards themselves within the region.
Yeah. So Paso is an interesting, like, you know, you're not going to say they just grow Cab or they just grow Rhone or they're, it's kind of been known for a mixture of different varieties. But I feel like there's such a sense of place here too, despite the fact that there's the people in the Bordeaux house and the people in the Rhone house and then the people in the Zin house, like kind of everything in between. And I think that comes from the intensity of the soils, the limestone soils, and the intensity of the climate, the intensity, if you just hear the terrain, like the way it looks just sticks in your brain. It's mountainous, but super close to the coast. There's really no other place like it in the world. And I think that comes through in all the wines. There's sort of this like intensity of flavor. You feel the sunshine, you feel the wind, you feel the ocean air. And I also think unable to be removed is also just like the community here. Like, I feel like you look at the word Paso Robles and you feel like this sort of communal, like far west winemaking sort of like renegade thing going on, which kind of goes along with that intensity. So those things are kind of just so completely combined in my mind in the wines. And when I go to wine tastings, you know, that have wines from all over the world and you taste a Paso wine, it just tastes different. You just know it's from here. And I think you know what I'm talking about because I can see your thing.
Yeah, the limestone, there's that undertone in everything. And if you love it, you love it. And it is interesting, too, that you talked about kind of that old Western feeling, you know, and I'll ask you to talk a little bit about, you know, people who want to visit Paso. But it is a distinctly different, as a visitor, it's a distinctly unique place. And Old West is kind of the way that I would start to characterize it versus Napa, Sonoma. You know, it's you feel that little bit of outlaw
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So for people that haven't been out there, you know, can you characterize it a little bit better and talk about some of the highlights as a visitor coming out to Paso?
Yeah, I definitely can, because it's definitely changed in terms of being more sort of high-end tourist, wine country tourist specific in the last 15 years as well. When I first moved out here, there were some hotels, there was only a couple. There were some good restaurants, but there were only a few. We are in San Luis Obispo County, which a lot of people outside of California, and even honestly, before I moved down here, I was not familiar with this county. We are equidistant between San Francisco and Los Angeles, about 3.5 hours from each. We have our own airport now, which has grown. And so you can fly in here on a jet. So you would fly into San Luis Obispo, which is a town that's, we call that South County. It's south of Paso Robles. And it's cooler. It's where Cal Poly is, which has also grown in notoriety over the last 15 to 20 years, which is an amazing Cal State school. So you fly into Slow, we call it Slow. You drive about 30 minutes north and you're in what's North County, which is wine country. You go uphill, you gain elevation. And so you kind of drive into these limestone hillsides that are now dotted with so many vineyards. And the heart of the wine country is the town of Paso Robles, which is a cowboy town. It was cowboys and almond farmers before it was winemakers. And, you know, in all the world, the crop always goes to the highest pay, whatever, the crop always becomes the highest paying crop, right? So like, it was almonds before. It was dry farmed to barley at some point, and now it's wine grapes. The downtown is adorable. It has a, it looks kind of like Healdsburg. It's got a central park in the middle. So not central park. It's got a middle park in the middle. And around it is the square with all the restaurants, and there's lots of tasting rooms. Now there's so many more hotels. We have Michelin-rated restaurants. Everything from Italian to Italian-French food kind of highlight, but then there's like a lot of American fare. There's just a lot going on. I don't know if you all have heard of a place called Sensorio in Paso. It's kind of divided between like Paso kind of, people talk about the west side and they talk about the east side. The west side's closer to the coast. It's more mountainous and it's a little bit more lush with oak trees. The east side's a little drier, but still has lots of oaks and beautiful rolling hills. Lots of vineyards over there too. But there's this property that got developed a few years ago and it's called Sensorio. And it is this artistic light display, which is now covering acres and acres of this incredible light art experience that you can do that it attracts people from all over. So you can do more than just wine now in Paso too.
It's been a number of years since I've been out, but I know after a day of wine tasting, we like to hit, there was a great Mexican place that had great margaritas. So that was a good palate cleanser at the end of the day. So
you'll have great Mexican food with great margaritas, probably even better alcohol in the margaritas now than there was back then. Yes, it is definitely, it's such a place to visit. Like the tourism is just off the charts, but you'll still feel, you know, like there aren't that many people and you'll meet locals and you'll meet winemakers. And that's the charm of Paso.
So how would you kind of define your ethos or philosophy of making wine? I mean, you know, you've got this unique place, you've got supportive ownership, you know, you've got great property. You know, let's talk a little bit about your own approach and what makes Jordan, Jordan.
I feel like hopefully I haven't said it too many times, so this won't be boring. But when I first moved here, you know, it was 2010, and I really wanted to make wines in line with what was like scoring high and like, kind of, there had been a couple vintages before I was here with another winemaker and they had done pretty well and it was just the beginning. And I was trying to like follow a little bit other people's footsteps. You know, Justin Smith from Saxum was our consulting winemaker when I first started too. And I was like, I wanting to, you know, not fall too far from the cart. But then over time, I sort of started to make more risky moves in terms of, I wanted to make wines that I knew would reflect the vineyard and the vintage really well. So not just trying to play such a hard winemaking hand at them, really trying to have them showcase the best of what our properties have to offer. And then also within our portfolio, you mentioned loving all the wines. I also want them to all taste different from each other. I don't want them to all just maybe taste like Syrah. So I just started to get busy at thinking about what did that mean for the different varieties. I want to have like a lighter red, a mid-range red, a heavier red in the portfolio. I really love vintage differences. We don't usually have like, you know, crazy rains throughout the summer and the fall. So our differences add up to how much rain did we get in the spring? How cold was the spring? When did the heat come? Was there an early frost? Those kind of things. Sometimes we'll get rain in the growing season, but it's usually pretty welcome. But all those things impact the wine. And being here long enough, I can look back at all the different vintages and tell you like what weather pattern and why the wine is the way it is. And that's what I really want. I tried to make Coca-Cola every year, and even though it tastes delicious, like it's not very different. And then wanted the wines to age. It was a hot vintage, cold vintage, whatever. I just wanted them to be age-worthy. I never wanted anyone to question whether our wines were too big, too showy, too much, that like they just kind of fell apart in the bottle. And yeah, so that's what I've kind of just every year just kind of picked away. I think we should do this. I think we should do this in the vineyard. I think we should do this in the winery. Not use too much oak, but use the right amount of oak to support the flavors. And yeah, the end has been like this really fun journey. And we opened a 2011 Tempranillo the other day, and it was just like gorgeous. So just makes me really happy.
Can you talk a little bit about, let's focus on that age-worthy thing. You know, what kind of things do you do as a winemaker to make a wine more age-worthy?
So yeah, it's hard. Picking decisions in the vintage are really big drivers of that. You have to be on top of your game at harvest. You can't, because like if you have 100-degree weather, every day is moving the mark. And depending on how ripe whatever variety, whatever block was at that moment, you wait an extra day, you wait extra 2 days to pick, and you're in a different zone of fruit ripeness than you were before. So definitely being on top of picking decisions, trying to pick on the early to perfectly side of ripe versus the perfect to late side of ripe, for me, has been really important for flavor and textural reasons. Using larger format oak, well-appointed new oak that's texturally supporting the wine, but not adding too much flavor, or adding flavor, but you don't notice it's from the oak. And we're really careful with oxygen exposure throughout the aging and not having anything but the grapes in the bottle, you know, like that also is like that, you know, this whole scary anti-alcohol movement. Okay, I get it. There's so much stuff out there to drink. There's spritzers, there's these alcoholic drinks at bars, there's ciders, there's like everything is out there right now. But wine has been here since the beginning of time. Drinking tons of it might not be good for anyone, but always having some in moderation, I do think has made like the French paradox what it is, and most people healthier. And I just can't imagine, I know I'm going off on a tangent now, but I can't imagine going to a Michelin restaurant, you know, or a really fine dining restaurant and not having even just like a sip of wine. Like, how could you enjoy the food? They're meant to be together.
I totally agree with that. We got into a discussion with some friends, a group of friends that have a wide range of ages. And we talked about how alcohol beverages sales are trending down. I'll add another one into the mix there, and that's the THC type beverages competing. And, you know, when we were talking about all the different alcohol, you know, wine, for me at least, wine is the only one that I would drink, even if it didn't have alcohol. I don't view it as an intoxicant.
It's part of your lifestyle and your meal. Like, that is exactly how I see it too, because I live it and breathe it. If I'm making wine-making decisions, I'm making them at 8 or 9 in the morning for blending, because that's the best time to taste. It's not an enjoyable time to get like intoxicated or to really enjoy the wine, but it's the best time for me to make a decision. It's part of the senses, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about, and I'll try to describe this since this is a podcast. So when you buy wine from Jordan at Epic, one of the cool things that comes in the box is these vinpressions. So if you can imagine something like the size of a large postcard with a piece of art on it, my impression is that it's your visual description of what the wine tastes like. So can you tell us a little bit about the birth of those and how they're done and all that good stuff?
Yes, definitely. That's a great description. When the 2010s, which were my first vintage here, I had bottled 08s and 09s, but when the 10s were getting ready to be released, I felt really close to them. And I remember I had mentioned, I studied engineering and science, but then I was also like a visual art person. Wines, if you do our wines, any wines, if you're doing all that you can in the vineyard and the winery. You're really not trying to alter the flavors and the aromas. Like, I want what Mother Nature gave us. What's really important for me when I'm blending is the texture. And texture is really hard to describe in words, and it'd be kind of boring too, honestly. Yes, it's hard to talk about these on a podcast, but when the 2010s were getting ready to release, I wanted to connect to the consumer a little bit more versus like just writing my tasting note. I wanted to show them what I felt on my palate. And I started doing these. I'd always thought about the textures of the wines in my palate as shapes. And because I have this science background, I wanted everyone to be able to relate to it in more of a scientific, like not woo-woo out there artistic way. I decided to draw these shapes on a graph. And so I graphed my palette and I created these drawings to go along with my tasting notes, and we call them vinpressions. So they are basically the impression of the wine as it moves from the front to the back of my palate. The palate is basically the top of the tongue to the roof of the mouth, and they move from left to right, which would be front to back of your palate. And I've done it for every wine, every red wine we've made and released since, gosh, that was probably like 2012. I want to put them together in a coffee table book. I've led some sort of like, I don't want to call them master classes because it's just my thing, but I've done some classes at like the Museum of Art in San Luis Obispo, at a local art gallery and studio called Studios on the Park in Paso, and in our own walls for our members. I've made a video, which it's on our website, that explains it a little bit better. It's a journey. I'm actually working with a local artist right now who loves them. She really wants me to add color. I see them in black and white. They're graphite drawings, but you know, I'm along for the journey to see where these things take us. They're really fun. You have our Grenache, our sensibility. You'll see that it tends to hang out more on the front palate of the wine, more on the left side of the drawing. If it's a Syrah, it's more of a full palate wine. It goes from front to back, you know, kind of shows the different weights of the wines too.
Well, I definitely love them. And it's just a little added extra when I get a case of wine. So I know that your great marketing people will let the world know when you get the coffee table book together.
Yes, I know. It's got to happen. I just time.
So as you've progressed in your career, if you're like me, you have an opportunity to share what you've learned with others, and especially those that are kind of up and comers. So have you taken those opportunities, and can you talk a little bit about your involvement, you know, in just making the wine industry better?
Oh, well, thanks. It's been like, I just love to mentor the interns. Like every year we have this incredible harvest intern positions. We usually hire, first it was started as one, then it was two. Now it's four interns every harvest where they can come and work under us and learn all of our winemaking practices and the reasons. And then they kind of go off after and like continue their winemaking journey. And I have so many people that I've mentored that way that are now like making amazing wine at other places. So that's been really great. I'm involved in some local nonprofits that are, you know, there's one that is supporting women in the beverage industry, young women who want to come up in the beverage industry. I'm also really working on that tie between like fine wine and fine art. I've been working with this artist, like I told you, she also runs this nonprofit art studio in Paso, and I'm on the board there. I'm actually president of the board. So really trying to bring that art community and the wine community together in Paso, something that people who visit can go see as well. Gosh, just constantly trying to, you know, push the envelope. The connections between winemakers here, winemakers throughout the world is also really important for Paso and then, you know, the winemaking world in general. And I love to collaborate.
Well, that's great. Jordan, thanks a lot for your time today. It was really great spending it with you. I wish we could be sitting here drinking wine while we're doing this, but that's life, right? So
one day we will. You'll have to let me know when you're coming to Paso and we'll do a barrel tasting. It would be great.
There you go. To our listeners, we hope you enjoyed this flavorful dive into the world of winemaking. Be sure to check out Epic Estate Wines online and explore the work that Jordan and her team are doing. And as always, stay tuned for our next episode. Till next time, may your glass always be full.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Next Gen Podcast. To learn more about our team and to join our exclusive educational events throughout the year, check out our website at advisors.ubs.com/Energen. If you have any suggestions on episodes you'd like to hear, let us know by emailing us at energen@ubs.com. And if you liked this episode, be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify to hear more. This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of any offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we recommend listeners to obtain appropriate and independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Incorporated offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct our business and that you carefully read agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products and services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Incorporated is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.